May it please the court, my name is Jeannie Willoughby and I'm here on behalf of the appellant Michael Tysius and Supreme Court number 91209. This is the direct appeal from Michael's penalty phase retrial. The jury recommended two sentences of death and the trial court imposed two sentences of death for two counts of first degree murder. In point one and argument one of the brief, we assert that the trial court abused its discretion by overruling defense counsel's hearsay objections to a portion of State's Exhibit 53. State's Exhibit 53 consisted of docket sheets, a sentence and judgment sheet, complaint and information from a previous case where Michael had entered an Alford plea of guilty to possession, to the Class B felony of possession of a prohibited article in the Department of Corrections. The trial attorney at the trial, and also we here, do not challenge the state's ability to use the sentence and judgment sheet and the docket entry that Michael had pleaded guilty to the Class B felony of possession of a prohibited article as a non-statutory aggravating evidence. What the we also agree that the state could have, and the trial attorney said this to the court and the prosecutor at the time, the state could have, if it had wanted to bring in particular circumstances surrounding the possession of a prohibited article, that they could have also, under this court's case law, brought in a witness. The witness, in other words, from the Department of Corrections that was present at the time of the possession of a prohibited article, to describe the circumstances and also to describe the article. At issue here, though, is that the state used the specific allegations that were in the felony complaint.
Right. But isn't the fact that it is a court charge, a non-hearsay use, that it is what he is charged with, and that's what the criminal proceedings progressed on. So it is the fact that was the charge against him that is admissible, not whether there are people out there who will can confirm that.
Right.
So isn't it a non-hearsay use that hearsay doesn't even apply?
I have two responses to that. One of them, a certified court document, is an exception to the hearsay rule and can come in under 49113. And that's what they're arguing in the brief, and that's what the prosecutor argued at trial. It's a certified document, so everything in the document comes in.
But it comes in because it's what he was charged with, not because it's proof that he did it. That it comes in because that's what's pending in court. His admission to it then is proof that that's what he did.
Okay, and I would respond that there are, as in State versus Clevenger, which is cited in the brief, a certified court document as a business record can contain inadmissible hearsay. So that's one response.
But that's not the purpose
okay,
of this document.
The way that the prosecutor used this was to say that they proved Michael actually specifically possessed a Vuitton. And here's the point that I wanted to get to. I've pleaded lots of people in court that plead guilty to the elements of a charge and the charge, but they don't necessarily match what the state is saying. And you can see this in cases, and furthermore, this was an Alford plea. But anyway, let's just say that he pleaded guilty to it and wasn't even an Alford plea. You see this in cases in 24035 appeals where criminal defendants are challenging the factual basis. And you'll see, I saw one last night, and I wasn't able to give it to Mr. Starnes, but Gravin versus State, 343 Southwest 3rd, 762. It sets forth that what the information said, the defendant says yes to the information. The information stated that the defendant caused the death of the victim by striking him. But then when the defendant was asked, well, what did you do? He said, well, I didn't actually strike him. I held him while somebody else struck him. So there are now the majority of times somebody's...
But for your purposes here, whether or not it was inappropriate to use the complaint, assume that was an inappropriate way to bring these facts, bring this issue before the jury. If you're going to show prejudice, don't you have to show that in your case, in fact, what he agreed to in the offered plea was different, so they were prejudiced, they read these allegations in the complaint, and they alleged different things than, in fact, he agreed the state could prove when he made his Alford plea, in order to show prejudice in light of the fact that you said you could bring in those facts in other ways. So
I think that it was aggravating evidence, so I don't think it was defense counsel's responsibility then to bring in the guilty plea transcript and say this.
But I'm just saying, from our point of view, you're asking us to reverse, so we need to look at whether or not it's prejudicial, don't we? And so how do we decide it's prejudicial if, in fact, in this instance, even though certainly it may not in many instances, it actually matched what he admitted the state could prove when he issued
it? It's outside of the record. I mean, there is a guilty plea transcript.
But we don't know what he agreed to.
Right. I mean, he made an Alford plea. We do know that. An Alford plea does not require a defendant to admit guilt.
But its consequences, he is convicted of what he was charged.
Of the crime with he was charged, not necessarily in the way the state is saying that he committed that crime.
Well, but when you make an Alford plea, haven't you made a choice in that regard? As opposed to, if you're looking at the actual factual basis of the plea, your argument might actually be better.
Yeah.
But when you make an Alford plea, you're basically admitting that what the state says the factual basis is that they could prove.
Well, what the defendant says is my understanding. That's right. What the defendant's saying, upon the advice of his attorney and his attorney's opinion about the strength of the case mm-hmm. and what facts make up it, it's my understanding that in order for the court to take it, the defendant has to say that I probably would be found guilty and I want to take this option of probation or whatever. I don't want to roll the dice. I would probably mm-hmm. be found guilty.
Right.
But it doesn't necessarily, we don't know, I mean, there is a guilty plea transcript, but I mean that the state, the prosecutor did not adduce that. They could have, I think, that would have been something else that they could have done.
Whose burden is it now to show prejudice? I mean, is it your burden to show that it was prejudicial because they did allege, you know, aggravating factors that weren't part of what he agreed they could prove?
I think that when they go to admit the document, and he's saying, you know, the defense counsel didn't have a problem with the whole complaint. He was specifically talking about the facts underlying the crime. He was in agreement that they could show what he was charged with, but not the specific facts of the crime.
And what Judge Stith is saying, is there any evidence that is not the crime to
not
which
in,
he
not in the
entered
record,
the offered plea?
Other than the, you know,
why
the,
isn't
when
it
the,
your,
when the,
when why, the, why don't you have to show it was prejudicial by showing it doesn't match? Why
because
is it the state's burden to
my understanding, death? My understanding is, defense counsel objects hearsay, and they use inadmissible evidence to argue to the jury that he had a boot shank, and inadmissible evidence, if inadmissible evidence comes in and is argued,
it's
then
their burden to show it's not prejudicial. You're saying
they have to, yeah. Okay. Unless it's harmless without question, then.
That gets to my question. Thank you.
Okay. But the point being that, you know, usually when someone pleads guilty, they admit, yes, the facts that the state is saying, but not always. And the defense expert was cross-examined by the prosecutor and said, isn't it true that he possessed a boot shank, or he was convicted of possessing a boot shank? And her response was, Michael told her that he was holding a piece of metal for someone else. So the point being also that you can be convicted of possession of prohibited item on something much less prejudicial than possessing a boot shank. And in this case, no, there is no evidence because we don't. I mean,
isn't that a problem with his prior choice in accepting the Alford plea and desiring to go forward with an Alford plea as opposed to he could have controlled his own factual basis.
Well, and I suppose that's true. There may have been a problem not with the item, but I mean there may have been an actual problem that I can't say under oath that.
Right.
You know,
I mean that's
mine,
one of the real dilemmas with Alford pleas in general. I'm not being critical of. I mean,
right.
The state says we have evidence to prove this beyond a reasonable doubt. the defendant doesn't necessarily have to admit it. He just has to say, yeah, there could be evidence beyond a reasonable doubt.
That's the Alford plea. Correct.
So, and you're saying, don't know right now whether or not the factual basis included that specific item or not.
Well, I have the guilty plea transcript, but I mean it's outside of the record. Mm-hmm. But I guess what our position is that the way that this was used by the state is much less egregious than what actually happened.
Couldn't you have offered the transcript?
I think the defense counsel probably could have, but my guess is defense counsel was focused on the mitigation in the case and wanted to stay as far away from this being any issue.
But wouldn't that given the jury additional information about exactly what he stated during the plea hearing?
And they could have called a guard from Potosi Correctional Center too. But the problem with that is you're having the defense counsel at least put on somewhat aggravating evidence when they wanted to focus on the mitigation. I mean, you're requiring them to call the guard or otherwise put on admissions or at least Michael's assessment through his attorney of the state's evidence in that case. You're requiring them to put that on when really their focus was, up to the prosecutor. If they want to introduce aggravating circumstances, they need to bring in their witness to say, I took this item from this location in his cell, you know, and this is what we found. Instead of whether it looks like a boot shank or whether it's a piece of metal, I could say in response to that, I mean, the defense expert called it a piece of metal. She didn't call it a boot shank. So that would be some evidence of that it was something less egregious than a boot shank.
You don't plead guilty to holding a piece of metal. So it had to.
Well, I mean.
What did he plead guilty to?
He pleaded guilty to possession of a prohibited item. Okay. And the statute as a Class B felony. And I did see one case where a man had State versus Williams, I believe, where a man had a 4-inch rod that was sharpened and that he was using for carving wooden chess pieces. That did not defeat the conviction for possession of the prohibited item on Department of Corrections. I mean, the definition of his definition, it's still not good.
Mm-hmm. Right.
The possession of prohibited item is still not good. It's not favorable, but.
Did he actually carve wooden chess pieces?
I just saw the summary of the case.
That was in the other case.
Yeah. In the other case.
Oh, yeah. No, I no. And so it's any gun, knife, weapon, or other article or item of personal property that may be used in such manner as to endanger the security of the correctional center or the city or county jail, or as to endanger the life of limb or any offender or employee of such a center. So it's not really, I think that a lot of...
So they don't use the term shank anywhere.
No, they use, it could be a weapon, it could be a shank. A shank would qualify, but right, it's not listed.
Thank you.
As something that he would have to have admitted to in order to be found guilty of it.
Thank you.
And it was hearsay. It was an out-of-court statement. The prosecutor who wrote that felony complaint, I mean, they could have redacted the part about the details of the crime, and defense counsel would not have had any issue with that. And he specifically argued to the court that they want to introduce these particular facts beyond what the charge and what he was convicted of.
Going back to my original question, you're saying that when someone pleads guilty to a crime, the only thing that is admissible from the court records to show the crime that was committed is the actual judgment, which is not going to have any of the facts. And so you're saying that the charging documents are never admissible because they would be hearsay, and that you'd always have to call in other witnesses and retry the case to show what he was convicted of?
Not to show what he was convicted. I mean, as a prior and persistent hearing in front of a judge, no. I think you could get the certified information
for a jury
and
a
judgment.
Phase.
But this is the jury
right,
determining.
Right, no, that's what I'm saying.
This is the jury determining.
When someone's found guilty, the judgment says they're found guilty of possession of illegal thing. And you're saying that they have to call a witness to come in and testify and to prove what happened, rather than rely on the court documents as to what the charge was that he was convicted of.
If they want to introduce the specific facts underlying the charge that he was convicted of, yes. Then
could,
they
could
need,
they
and
read
it's not
the,
that hard. They could call the guard from
could,
it.
Could they read the transcript of the guilty plea?
I don't know. I mean, I ordered it on my own.
No, I'm asking, are you saying that would be impermissible? Couldn't you show the facts?
I think that they could have. I think if there's admissions in the guilty plea transcript,
shows
I think the prosecutor could have ordered it and
said
he admitted.
But what he's pleading guilty to is the crime that is charged.
I'm sorry, now?
What he's pleading guilty to is the crime that is charged, and the crime that is charged includes the factual basis for that crime that is in the charging document.
But what a defendant pleads guilty to is the crime. Like I said before, you can, usually that's the case, but you can have guilty pleas where somebody admits other facts than what the state is asserting, and the judge still takes the factual basis.
But why was it their burden to disprove that that occurred here? I mean, that's an unusual situation. It could be. They could have pled to a slightly different crime, could have been amended, could have pled to different facts that still constituted the crime. But you haven't shown any evidence. That's just hypothetical, isn't it? Don't you have to relate that to claim to this case?
Well, I think that when you are using a complaint that's in the associate division and you're alleging the specific facts and the defense attorney is saying it's hearsay.
But that would be relevant.
I think that
would be that this complaint is not relevant because there's an information that is a subsequent charge,
well,
as opposed to that the document that charges the crime and sets up the factual basis for it, it consists of hearsay.
Okay, well, that's true. That would be irrelevant. So let's go back to what you said then. And it's our position that it's hearsay. It's an out-of-court statement. He read it as the Washington County prosecutor. He read to the jury, who was to decide between life and death, the Washington County prosecutor, under oath, swears that he has cause to believe that he possessed a boot shank. And that portion is coming from information outside of court. If they wanted to bring in the guilty plea transcript, a witness, but that portion of the complaint is hearsay. I don't think that it was it's our position that it wasn't once they objected to the hearsay, it wasn't then defense counsel's position to prove to the court that that's not what actually he pleaded guilty to. The rule 2402 requires before a guilty plea is accepted that certain questions be asked, that the defendant be sworn, defendant was not coerced, defendant's plea is voluntary, but there's different ways in which each trial judge accepts a factual basis. There's not a specific scenario or certain questions. They have to accept a factual basis, but there's not a specific scenario certain questions that they must ask. So, for example, I practiced in front of a circuit judge who would sometimes turn to or would often turn to the defendant and say, well, tell me in your own words what you did that makes you think you're guilty of this. And it would not match it would not necessarily match the state's information. So
But in that scenario, oftentimes the judge who does that he's already asked the state, what would your evidence be? And so that's what I'm trying to get at. Why, if the court accepts the factual basis in those scenarios, does that necessarily mean that the court had to accept the factual basis of the defendant? Or does it mean he had to accept the factual basis of the state? Or does the court get to consider the statements made by both sides in their totality?
Well, I think that, you know, when I looked at some of the, like I said, the 24 through 5, that's Gravin versus State, he said something different that was in the information. The factual basis was accepted. That really wasn't the issue in the case. But, I mean, I think that the case law is that the court determines it from the record in total.
Mm-hmm. which in this case could have been, especially since it was an Alford plea and the defendant maybe didn't actually admit guilt. I mean, the whole, oftentimes in Alford pleas, the court is really left with a factual basis as outlined by the state,
right,
based upon what the state says the evidence would be.
Right. There's other cases too like that. There's Evans versus Missouri, 350 Southwest 3rd, 29. The woman pleaded guilty before any lab report came back, and when asked if the substance she possessed was methamphetamine, she said, "I don't know, I'm pretty sure it was," and the factual basis was accepted for that. I mean, there are other cases, and this just illustrates what I think happens in circuit courts, that a factual basis is not always exactly as the state is saying it, and sometimes the defendant admits something slightly differently. I only say this to point out that the complaint, the factual basis in the complaint, should not be deemed an admission by the defendant. I mean, that's why I'm pointing this out. The Alford plea definitely comes in, the sentence and judgment sheet, what he was charged with in terms of the crime and the elements of the crime, judicial notice of the statute that sets forth the elements of the crime. But when you start getting into the specific facts alleged by the state, that's where you're getting into out of court statements that the state in this case then used to argue the truth of the matter asserted, that he actually possessed a boot shank, which of course in a case where the jury is to decide between life and death is especially prejudicial. And here there was considerable mitigation. I mean, it was a very sad case, of course, very, very terrible for these officers and their families, but it was a very sad case. I mean, he was only 19 years old. He had a terrible home life. All of that is set forth in the brief. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Mr. Starnes?
May it please the court. First of all, as we point out in our brief, the prosecutor should have read the information instead of the complaint. However, in this case, they're identical. The same exact language about the prosecutors basically lifted the charge language from one, put in the other. We believe the information is exactly what a defendant admits to in entering a plea. And in this case especially, the information is what is the factual allegations, the elements that the state charges, and the defendant, in this case, admits that there's sufficient evidence of that crime. At the very least, the state's presented a prima facie case that appellant possessed a prohibited item, which was a weapon or an item that could be used as such. Now, the trial court, for some reason, it took that language out, took part of the element language out of the description, took the weapon or something that could be used as a weapon out, but left in the boot shank. If the court had done, you know, had properly left all the rest in, the boot shank part is irrelevant because the appellant would have admitted that he had, or at least admitted that there was evidence, sufficient evidence to prove beyond a reasonable doubt, that he possessed a weapon, which was the whole point of what the prosecutor was trying to establish. The boot shank language was in the information. Appellant entered an Alford plea to that charge. There's no indication in the exhibit, in the record, that charge had ever been amended. The state presented certified copies of the document showing that is what appellant admitted that he was that there was evidence to prove him guilty of. Appellant even conceded that the elements can be introduced, and if the elements include a weapon, I don't know how appellant could possibly be prejudiced by saying boot shank instead of weapon, when what the state wanted to prove is he's possessing weapons in the Department of Corrections. I'm also, to some of the things that Judge Breckenridge said, in evaluating and thinking about this case, I almost thought about it for a little bit as the charging document, after the plea is entered, is in essence almost the written equivalent of a verbal act. It's not being introduced to prove that the prosecutor believes that these facts are true, which is what the complaint said. It's being introduced to show that this is the crime that the defendant pled guilty to. Or in this case, admitted that he was guilty, that the evidence showed he was guilty of. In that sense, The charging document essentially in a plea case becomes an admission, an adopted admission, the defendant essentially admitting to what the state had alleged without it.
Or the defendant could object that the charging document differed from what was admitted to.
Right.
And show some difference that the court accepted the plea on some other basis.
Exactly. And the record made at trial made it look like their objection was to form, not to substance. And counsel engaged in some speculation, so I'll too. My guess is that the plea record would have shown exactly what the certified document showed, that appellant admitted that the state has sufficient evidence of guilt of what was alleged in the information, that he possessed an item, prohibited item, commonly known as a boot shank, which is a weapon or an item that could be used as a weapon. There just isn't, it's admissible as a certified copy. It's admissible as an admission. We do believe that in the context of the question and answer that the expert witness did incorporate, he was found guilty of a boot shank. Well, he said it was a piece of metal, that it also made it cumulative. And in fact, the appellant got the opportunity to make an explanation for what he was really doing and to try to minimize the prejudicial effect of it, not having to testify himself, but through his expert witness. As to the prejudice question, the state believes that prejudice burden rests on the defendant. I'm not aware of any case that says dealing with the admission of evidence, the wrongful admission of evidence, that the burden shifts. There have been cases to state that the exclusion of relevant defense evidence can result in that. I think there is a distinction between excluding relevant exculpatory evidence and the form of the introduction of this evidence here. As the appellant only maintained their argument as to the hearsay point, didn't get into the confrontation issue or parts of any other point, unless there are any questions. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
May it please the court. The only other thing that I wanted to mention with regard to, and I did limit my time to the first point, is that in addition to the prejudice of the boot shank, the prosecutor, when cross-examining the defense expert, specifically brought out, have you been to prisons before to conduct evaluation, and do you know what a shank is? And isn't it true that a shank is a homemade tool that the inmates sharpen up so they can use them as weapons against inmates and guards? And then the prosecutor went on to argue in closing, he has a boot shank. This overall use of the boot shank portrayed Michael as actually carrying it on his person.
Was there an objection made to that argument?
There was not an objection made to that argument. A few lines later, the prosecutor says he's going to continue to be a danger to society. I think at that part, the evidence of the boot shank had already come in. But here again, the boot shank is taken out of context, not only in the sense that it's the item that he has, but it makes it sound as if boot shank, as if it's a shank that he's got in his boot or he's carrying it on his person, when that is not what the crime was, and there was no evidence. You can be in possession of something, let's say that's in your cell, that's not on your person. And that's also less threatening or less prejudicial to a jury than the way that this was portrayed to this jury, who was to decide between life and death. So if there's no further questions.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.